His name is Luca. That's right, listener. Today we go into the Viali as we look back on the legend's career, from the one and only Pizzicatoni to a champ at Samp to the big thing in Turin. It's all coming up in part one of a special double Galazzo on Gianluca Viali. Ciao, everybody, and welcome to another Golazzo. As is traditional, we're joined here by Gabriele Marcotti. Ciao, Gab.
Hello.
And tanti saluti a James Horncastle.
Bentornato.
Merci. And what a great time to be talking about one of the greats, Gianluca Viali, finally reunited with Roberto Mancini.
His old partner in crime from the Sampdoria days.
His goal twin. Crazy to think that there was a time when you could rock up to the stadium and watch Luca Viali and Roberto Mancini play side by side.
Yeah, one of the great strike partnerships, one of the great friendships, I think, in the game. I remember going to interview Mancini when he was at Inter second spell. I think they were playing Celtic and Viali was on the plane. And we spoke and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm going to interview your twin, essentially." And he insisted that I kind of record a message and play it to him.
Oh, that's nice.
So, yeah, and as you say, back together, Viali, capo delegazione of the national team. So he's kind of
team manager,
head of the party, if you like.
Sort of the Adrian Bevington in South Africa.
I mean, it's seen as more than just this kind of ceremonial role, I think, in Italy. Gigi Riva had it for years and was always seen as a big part of making the atmosphere, setting the tone at the national team kind of
big but laconic part of
Gigi Riva.
of the Azzurri success. Gab, you spent how many years working with Gianluca, writing that book, The Italian Job?
I mean, we kind of rocked up here in the Scepter Dial at the same time, way back in the mid-90s. He is a footballer at Chelsea. He is a freelance journalist, initially. So I covered him throughout all his time there, and then I got a call from him. I remember I was at UEFA in Neon in 2003, maybe, and I got a call from him, and he says, like, "Hey," so, because he was getting his pro license from Coverciano, and he basically said, "Look, I've written this thesis. I want to turn it into a book. I want to go do loads of interviews. Do you want to do it with me?
You can help me."
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, "Do you have Filippo Ricci's number?" No. So I said, "Yeah," and it turned into the book, The Italian Job, which...
Still available
somewhere, yeah. Which
film rights still available.
But the reason it was fantastic, you know, it's probably the most rewarding thing I've done professionally.
Sorry. Aside from this show.
Oh,
yes, the joke, yes. Other than taping these podcasts with you in Horncastle, is that basically what we do in the book, we go around to all the people who were the top managers and people in football at the time. And the great thing about doing it alongside Luca is he just rings up Sir Alex Ferguson or Marcello Lippi or Fabio Capello and says, "Hey, can I come by next week for a couple hours? And can we just talk football?" And so I accompanied him in this, and everybody likes him. So every door pretty much opened instantaneously. That's a different issue. But it was tremendous. And it was just such an eye-opener. You know, we went to the Arsenal training ground, and sitting around me, Luca, and Arsene Wenger after training, and then all of a sudden it's dark, and then you realize that apart from the security guards, like, you know, Arsene Wenger, Luca, and you are the only people left at the training ground talking about football. You know, similar experience with Sir Alex Ferguson, with so many of these guys. We even spoke briefly to Luciano Moggi, who probably...
He really explained how football was.
Exactly. He gave a different view.
Okay, well, Luca, not an average football player in terms of skill or in terms of personality. Let's begin our look back at his career back at the dawn of the 80s. That's right, James Horncastle. The 5 years before you were born released La Mia Banda Suona il Rock by Ivano Fossati.
Do they not play any other kind of music?
Well, I think they do. But it is a big hit from 79-80 when a 16-year-old called Gianluca Viali has just joined his local club, Cremonese. And
you're skipping.
Well, okay, so he joined that other little club first.
Well, but the reason it's relevant
because of his age?
No, the reason it's relevant is the club that he joined before Cremonese has one of those names that sound, and it's a town, and it's right near where one half of my family's from, so it's an area I know very, very well. And it's and he's, as a kid, every time we drive by, we'd see the sign to it, and we'd be like, oh my God, what kind of weirdos and losers live there?
Right.
The town, of course, is known as Pizzighettone, which sounds absolutely ridiculous and idiotic. And that was Luca's first team.
Okay. But I think he only had a very short time there before
he was there for a year, I think.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about his background. People always talk about the castle.
Yeah.
But he does come from an unusual background for a footballer. And how much was that an issue, even for his family, him taking up a career as a professional footballer?
All right. So there's a couple of things. So first of all, the area of Italy where he's from, it's near Cremona, which is also, again, where the Marcottis hail from. Mm. And Cremona, it's about maybe 45 minutes or an hour south of Milan. But this is where you have the Po River Valley in the north of Italy, where things get really, really flat. Mm. It's all farmland. Cremona, also the city of... Cremona's most famous son is probably Stradivari, who made the violins. Mm.
There's an amazing violin museum in there. It's a UNESCO heritage site. But there's a kind of, I think, Japanese-designed auditorium as well.
Yeah. With amazing acoustics. Mm. Cremona is also down... I mean, it's the kind of area where... I don't know if you saw the film Call Me By Your Name by Luca Guadagnino. Yes. That's, you know, if you want an idea of
Crema?
Well, it's in Crema, which is...
Which is Alessio Tacchinardi's town. But yes,
Riccardo Ferri's hometown as well. Mm. But it's also the most famous...
It's rich farmland, essentially.
Yeah. It's the poorest province in Lombardia.
Really?
Which is a little bit like, you know, being sort of... the shortest Harlem Globetrotter, probably the greatest female singer in Italian history,
Mina,
is from Cremona. Right. And she's still probably, alongside Stradivari, the most famous Cremonese. And Luca, of course.
And Luca, of course. He has a lot of brothers. Was it an accepted thing that he was just going to become, at 16, a professional player?
I think because he's one of the younger ones. Mm. I think by that point...
He's the youngest, I think.
Yeah, I think he is the youngest, actually. I think by that point, they were like, okay. Like,
they already had the priest, the lawyer, the doctor.
Yeah, we've kind of ticked these other boxes. And, you know, I asked him, what would you have been if you'd not been a footballer? And it's funny because the answer he gave me at the time was, well, I like building things, so maybe an architect. Or and he says, or more likely a professional soldier. Which I thought was pretty telling, not because he likes...
He got to do that when he went to Juventus, of course.
Right. Well, and, the Marine.
I think what moved him at the time was the fact that he liked the training, the physicality, the competition, the pushing yourself. You know, a lot of the values that you might see in the military, and obviously which are very much the reality in Italian football, especially in those years.
So he's a young player at
Pizzighettone.
And makes the move across to Cremonese. They're down in C1, the third division at the time. Mm-hmm. They win a promotion. Who's the manager?
Well, it becomes Mondonico.
Mondonico.
And because Mondonico is the coach of the youth team, he then steps up, replaces the guy who gave Viali his debut. And Viali is a part of the side and the top scorer of the side, which... gets promoted to Serie A for the first time in 54 years.
Wow.
And that was a time when, that was the 82-83 season,
yeah,
I believe. And that was a time, though, of course, where, you know, you became top scorer with like 7 goals. I don't know how many he scored in Serie B that season. But,
it was 10.
So it's a slightly different era. 1982, of course, was the year that, you know, post-World Cup, was the year of Platini, Boniek. Italian clubs are now allowed to have 2 foreigners. They couldn't have any until 1980. They go out there and they start bringing in loads of foreign players. And he's like, well, I don't know any of these guys. I don't trust anybody to bring anybody in. So they actually started the season without any foreigners. And everybody thought he was absolutely mad. He just essentially kept most of the same players.
From Serie B.
They would sign players like not only Viali, but... Lombardo, I think Prandelli, before he went to
Lombardo
Atalanta.
Lombardo came through Cremonese?
Yeah.
Wow.
And there was again one of those kind of preferential routes, let's say, what they call it now, and it's synergy between one of the big clubs and them.
Right.
Cremona and Cremonese would keep coming back into Gianluca's life insofar as his debut for Sampdoria was against Cremonese.
Very much so.
And the second leg, I think, of the 89 Coppa Italia final. They couldn't play it at Marassi because it was undergoing renovation work for the World Cup, and so they played it at Cremona.
Wow.
And that's where Samp beat Napoli, Diego Maradona's Napoli.
And one of his greatest ever Serie A goals was against Cremonese.
And when I ask him, and I think it might be slightly wind up, slightly not, a guy who I'm sure nobody will remember, not even you, James, possibly, as a scholar of Italian football history, ask him who the most gifted player he ever played with was. You expect him to say Mancini, probably, but no. He mentions...
Dennis Wise.
No, funnily enough. He mentions a guy named Alviero Chiori, who was sort of this cult hero. You know, he's still very, very rude. And again, I go back to this, right? He built a house there in a small town called Grumello. And it's just where my grandmother lived until she passed. That's where my dad grew up. I have a lot of affection for this place. It's not really the sort of place you would ever really want to go there by choice, because in the summer, it's really oppressively hot. Simply because it's this like horrendous, very humid, hot microclimate. In winters, it gets really cold, and also you have major issues with fog. Mm. So it's not really a pleasant place to go unless you're from there and are visiting family. But he still remained very, very much anchored to that place.
And I should say, final point, James, is that as with Mancini, wherever Gianluca went, all of a sudden these teams that never won anything started to win things. So Cremonese get promoted. They become a yo-yo club. Of course, they're one of the teams that won the Anglo-Italian Cup, beating Derby County in the early 90s. And yeah, it was the same at Samp. It's the same at Juventus, who people think Juventus win every year. Since the beginning of time, they hadn't won a league title in 9 years before Gianluca got there. And likewise at Chelsea later on. No history.
All right, know your history. In 84, the next step in Gianluca's path to glory, the move to Liguria and Sampdoria. Vamos a la playa, oh, oh, oh. Vamos a la playa, oh, oh, oh. That's right, Gab, it is Rigueira with the appropriately titled Vamos a la playa, which is what Gianluca was doing. Boniperti from Juve called to ask your friend Luzzara Cremonese, can we buy Gianluca Vialli? They said £4.5 million. I don't know what the equivalent would have been, what, 15 billion lira. And Boniperti went, no. So he went to Liguria, the lucky chap, the Riviera, possibly one of the most exquisite bits of the Italian peninsula.
We know who recruited Vialli. I mean, it was Roberto Mancini, essentially, in that they played on the 21s together. And what Mancini wanted, Mancini got at Samp.
Mancho. And he met, he reunited there with his under 21 buddy, the Azzurrini, together again, Mancini and Vialli, in a pairing that was to be known as the Gemelli del Gol, the Gol twins. That wasn't all he found at Sampdoria. He also found Trevor Francis, who Paolo Mantovani, the visionary Sampdoria owner, brought in with Mancini back in 82 as part of his building towards.
It was big Suey there as well.
And Graham Souness arrived.
Champagne
same,
Charlie.
Same time as Gianluca Vialli. Graham Souness.
84.
They play together and they win, in fact, the Coppa Italia. The first trophy that I think Sampdoria had ever won came that same season. As you say, he arrives, they start winning.
I think Souness scored on his debut. He scored the bendiest free kick you're ever going to see.
Wow, bendier than the Roberto Carlos trademark.
No, I mean, he was much closer to goal. It wasn't hit as hard. And I remember as a kid watching and hearing the commentator say, like, and I thought it was such an appropriate turn of phrase, something James Richardson would have been proud of. It was something like, Souness mette il veleno nel pallone. Like, Souness puts poison in his in the ball, in the strike.
I was going to say, he also scored in the first leg of the Coppa Italia, a two-legged final against Milan, and he scored away at San Siro, and then they beat them 2-1 in the return. Brilliant. What a lineup that was. Paolo Mantovani, who was the man, the father of the golden era at Sampdoria, and also the father of Enrico Mantovani, rather less, you know, in football terms, successfully. But he was piecing together an extraordinary team. The Ecuador coming in 81... As I mentioned, Mancini and Trevor Francis in 82. You have Pari in 83, Vialli, Manini, Souness in 84, Cerezo in 86, Pagliuca in 87.
Was very much the strategy of Mantovani, his kind of genius, which was to invest in two or three of the best kind of under-23 Italian players every year. And this was a very good generation coming through, as that Azzelio Vicini on the 21 side, which would then become post 86, the kind of Italy side that I think a lot of people got familiar with, Italia 90.
Mm. And that was a side, of course, that in 1985 lost the final of the European under-21s, which, of course, as you know, to us in Italy, it's a big deal because we actually
win it all the time.
Yes, because we actually win competitions
and stuff.
Five out
of seven, I think, that you guys had won.
But they didn't win in 1985 because they reached the final and they were beaten by a Spain team, which included, I believe, Michel and Butragueño and all those guys.
Wow.
They were beaten on penalties and they were so cocksure and so confident. And lesson learned. But I think 10 of those 11, because Beppe Giannini was on it, a whole bunch of guys who then went on to play for the Italy side.
Well, amongst them, Vialli and Mancini, who are now reunited at Samp, and they start winning things. Three Coppa Italias they win. They get all the way to the Cup Winners' Cup final against Barcelona in 89, where they take on a Barcelona team featuring Gary Lineker.
Just to give an idea of how successful this Samp side was and where they came from, because Mantovani bought them when they were in the second division. And then I think they reach 8 finals in the space of 4 years. Yeah, we're talking, I think, 3 Coppa Italia finals, whilst Vialli's there.
All three that they win, yeah.
Yeah, 2 Cup Winners' Cup finals. Obviously, the European Cup final and Italian Super Cups. We're talking European Super Cups as well. They were in a final, I think, every year between 88 and 92. Which is still extraordinary, even when you look at the kind of players that they had. You mentioned some of them, but let's not forget who they're competing against. They're competing against the Inter side that racked up a record points when it was 2 points for a win on the Trap and the Germans. You've still got Milan and the Dutchmen, who, when they win the league, they are the reigning European champions. Maradona's Napoli, I mean, we could go on.
Juve.
Yeah.
Even if they don't win every year. And also, and they're not just a really talented team put together, but I think they're a side that's viewed with a nostalgia and a kind of, there's a glow about that team because they were such a wonderful group of players, the chemistry between them. People talk about the group that the Vialli Mancini had, the seven dwarves that would come together every Thursday evening to play cards and shoot the crap with their friends. And it was just, you know, they would dye their hair blonde, they would dress up as pirates, they would dress up as Europe, they would do all that stuff. They were a breath of fresh air.
I think one of the things about this was Vialli had a slightly different background, possibly because he's sort of a natural extrovert. They all kind of embraced them, right? They were all likable. And there's incredible dichotomy between him and Roberto Mancini, where Mancini was super quiet and, in fact, shy off pitch. On the pitch, there was no question who the leader was, and it wasn't Luca. And he was very happy to sort of defer that. I mean, neither one was the captain at the time. The captain was the Pellegrini, the sweeper. They added this sense of fun to everything, which meant that, I don't want to say they were everybody's second team, but it, among fans of the traditional big clubs, nobody minded if Sampdoria won, you know, relative to everybody else.
We also had an incredibly sympathetic manager, Budgetin Bosco.
Yeah, who I think is worthy of his own Galazzo episode at some point. But
a man who'd coached everywhere, including in China. I remember him talking about explaining football to Chairman Mao.
Okay.
And because I was talking about
Yugoslav.
Did you say Chairman Mao? But he was already off talking about something else.
But I mean, this was all, I think, part of the great family atmosphere that there was at Samp. I mean, Vialli famously said that. I mean, he is repeatedly courted by Milan and Juventus whilst he's at Sampdoria. And he said he'd go into these meetings with Paolo Mantovani, come out feeling, you know, 10 feet tall, and would go to bed in Samp pyjamas.
And if he felt down, he says, Boskov would send him home to Mrs. Boskov, who would give him tea and pasticcini. And it worked. Yeah, an incredible atmosphere. And I guess maybe it was a different time for football, but Milan came in for him, Napoli came in for him, Juve came back in for him, Real Madrid came back in for him. Famously, he turned down, or the quote was when he turned down one offer from Berlusconi, that it's very flattering, but you can't see the sea from Milano Due. Because that's another thing we should mention. There can't be a nicer place to live than
Milano Due,
than that coastline. I mean, between Nervi and Boliasco, where the training ground is, it's just glorious coastline. You have
the sea on one side, you've mountains, got wonderful mountains on the other.
Yeah, you have Portofino as well.
All those little, Nervi as well, a lovely little town.
It depends, though. There's no sandy beaches. Yeah. That's the flip side.
That's true.
They're all rocky beaches.
Well, they were having some fun. He, in the Seven Dwarves, was known as... Which one was he?
Well, Mancini was dopey, no?
Mancini was dopey. Paolo Borea, who was the architect of the team, was Doc. Oh, Gianluca was Pizzolo, which I think is it Droopy, the sleepy one?
Yeah.
Oh, Sleepy, sorry, right. Not Droopy.
But I think, again, this is the other thing, is that the Seven Dwarfs, they're not all seven players.
No.
There's the sporting director, there's the youth team coach. So yeah, it's very...
And yeah, Manini was another player who was in the group, but yeah, it was very much a mix, and then they were kind of the central command and of the team, and that was the core around which everything was built. And
it was a clique. It was a cliquish team, mm. and I think it worked because of the people who were at the top of the clique, because, I mean, there was definitely circles of influence. And in fact, I haven't heard the story from Luke. I've heard it from other people. Mantovani was in on this. He wasn't one of the Seven Dwarfs, but he made these little pins called the Cerchia Blu, the Blue Circle, and he gave them to people who were allowed to be in the Blue Circles. Mancini got
little
one.
Little circle of trust.
Mancini got a little pin. Luca did not.
Ooh.
It was indicative of the fact that it was all kind of taken slightly tongue-in-cheek.
That partnership on-field and off-field, because they shared a room together and they were friends and they complimented
They used to go on jet skis, didn't they?
That's right.
That was the other thing. I don't know whether they lived on the seafront, but they could just go down and get on a jet ski and just whiz around before training.
Can't do that in Milano, do we?
You've got the artificial lake. You can go and do that.
8 glorious years there, where a club with very low expectations at the start began to win everything and anything, including, finally, in 1991, the Scudetto.
Listeners, I'm Kate Borsay, and have I got a podcast for you? Well, yes, I do, because it's all about football and it's called The Offside Rule WSL Edition. It's hosted by me, Kate Borsay, and Lindsay Hooper, a very fine combination we are too. And every week we get a whole host of different names and voices from women's football to talk to us about the latest news and action on and off the pitch. We've had England striker Nikita Paris.
This is what we've earned. We've earned the right to be playing at Wembley. We've earned the right to be playing in front of 77,000.
England goalkeeper Karen Bardsley.
You said that you want to make goalkeeping sexy. How do you plan about doing that?
That's awesome. Well, I don't have to do much, do I?
And Joe Montemuro joined us live from the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium.
For me, it just indicates the growth of the league and that a lot of big players want to come and play for the big clubs in the WSL.
If you like the sound of that, then search now for the Offside Rule WSL edition wherever you're listening to this and get some women's football in your life. The Offside Rule WSL edition, because women play football too.
You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show.
1991 and Sampdoria, provincial side, founded when? 46 by the fusion of two clubs?
Well, this is the thing. You've got the oldest team in Italy is in Genoa, and then you've got these upstarts, Samp, who are the part of a fusion.
Between Sampierdarenese from Sampierdarena, which
Andrea
I have no
Doria.
Idea what it is, and the Andrea Doria. But of course, as you'll recall, the Andrea Doria was also a famous ship, which sank, and years later, Geraldo Rivera opened the safe and found that there was nothing inside.
Nothing inside. Right. Andrea Doria was one of the captains on Columbus's trip, wasn't he? Cristoforo Colombo. I believe that's who Andrea Doria was, but I might be wrong about that. History fans will correct me. Anyway, there they were. What a team like that, winning the Scudetto against, as you mentioned, all the big powers in Serie A. How big an achievement, how big a turn-up was that?
Looking at their various successes over that period, he's top scorer. I think he still holds the record for 13 goals in the Coppa Italia. He's top scorer in the Cup Winners' Cup, I think, when they go to the final and win it. And he scores twice in the final against Anderlecht. And he scores, 19 goals in this season when they win the league.
I mean, the thing about Vialli as a goal scorer, if you go back, you notice that he was nowhere near as prolific as a lot of people thought he would be, or as a lot of these Galazzos that we've done about a lot of these dudes who score a lot of goals. But he scored really spectacular goals, and he scored really important goals. I mean, he still scored a ton of goals as well. And I think part of that was down to him playing with Mancini, who's such an atypical striker, just his movement and everything. And I think a big part of it was also him pushing himself to try different things. It was this period, I think it was with the national side, where he had missed a bunch of chances, and because he was always volleying the ball or hitting it first time. And I remember him being asked, why don't you just control it and then shoot? And he said, because if I hit it first time, obviously I gain that extra split second on the goalkeeper. Like, he said, look, if I'm not scoring, I just need to finish better. It's not a question of not shooting first time. It's just a question of me improving. And I think that really marked the ethos that he liked to give out. You know, he had sort of the big curly hair. And then I remember the 1986 World Cup, which is when he was called up into the national side. And obviously, this being Italy, the magical country where you're young until you're 50. The 1986 World Cup was a summer that he turned 22. He was born July 9th, 1964. And so you would think a guy like Vialli today, or if he were English, he'd be like Raheem Sterling, you know, like 50 caps by that age, right? But back then, you know, you had to go earn your way.
So even to this day, you're young in Italy until you're 28, you know.
No, you're young until you're well beyond 28. But I remember at that World Cup, I think Italy had, it was like Galderisi up front, or, you know, who...
He kept coming on for Bruno Conti.
Yeah, he kept coming on the wing, right? Because, you know, the kid needs to run up and down and work hard. And he did whatever was asked of him. So I think he always saw himself as like a fully rounded footballer and not just as a center forward.
It's his goals that win them their first ever trophy, their first ever international trophy, sorry, I should say. Mm. In fact, their only international trophy, the Cup Winners' Cup, in 1990 when they beat Anderlecht in Gothenburg 2-0, a brace from Gianluca Vialli.
In penetrazione Mancini, parte il cross, gol! E gol ancora di Vialli! Gol! Gianluca Vialli! Gol della Sampdoria, 2-0! Rivediamo! I gemelli del gol!
Set up there by Mancini. And then in 91, as we say, the Scudetto, which was sealed on the 19th of May, 1991, with the game against Lecce. And the celebrations, James.
There's so much to get through here, James, because on the day they actually win the league title and they're at Marassi, they put on wigs, don't they? And they say it's such a miracle that even Lombardo and I think Vialli have sprouted hair again. And then at the
actual... If you were here, you would point out that he had hair at the time.
Okay.
He just chose to shave his head.
Yep, just as James does.
That was the first time that I'd heard this idea that if you shave your head, it strengthens the roots. And when he shaved his head, it was a big thing. And people were kind of, what's he doing? And that was the reason that he wanted to stave off baldness. He was taking on baldness. Mm. A fight, this fight that he wouldn't win, but others, thankfully, he would.
And then they had a big party in the city in Genoa, and they basically announced that Europe, the band, by the Final Countdown, were going to play, but it wasn't Europe who were playing. It was basically the Samp players all dressed in wigs, dressed
backed
as
by
Europe.
Italian rock act The New Trolls.
Yeah. One of your favourites, James?
One of my favourites. But yeah, amazing scenes as this played, and Lombardo...
His wig falls off as he goes into a guitar solo.
It's magnificent, anyway.
It's the best thing on YouTube that features Lombardo after the Lombardo.
Ah, yeah. All right, well, Europe, the Final Countdown, and as it turns out, Luca's Final Countdown was already underway because he plays another season at Samp. But by this point, Paolo Mantovani, I think it's fair to say, has decided that it might be time to cash in on his most valuable player, rebuild the team with the money, and thus he accepts an offer from Juventus. So summer 92, after 8 years, that the romance has finally ended. But there's one more game to play, and it is the European Cup final, which Samp, having won the Scudetto in 91, have battled all the way through to the last game at Wembley, where they are taking on once again the side that had beaten them in that Cup Winners' Cup in 89, Barcelona.
Not just any Barcelona, James.
Not just any Barcelona.
It's the Grand Dream Team.
Okay, so...
the Johan Cruyff.
Johan Cruyff's Barcelona. Some of the names involved include Hristo Stoichkov, Michael Laudrup, Ronald Koeman, and a young Pep Guardiola.
And Chapi Ferrer, of course.
Well, so many other players.
Chapi Ferrer would later join Luca, obviously, at Chelsea. And I remember in his sort of first unveiling at the press conference, you know, he was asked about the 92 Cup final, and Gianni says, yeah. And then somebody asked him, like, do you remember who missed what should have been the winner at the end of regular time? And he starts laughing and he says, like, yes, my new boss.
Right. Yeah, Vialli misses a couple of chances. Sam didn't play well, I think it's fair to say, in that game.
I think Paliuka was their best player.
Huh? Yeah. And Vialli himself misses a couple of chances. There's a Mancini sets him up for one, which he puts over. And there's another chance, which he puts wide to Bruno Pizzol's consternation.
Eccolo! 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 E il pallone va fuori! Ancora una volta la Sampdoria va di sinistra al gol. Incredibile!
And then in extra time, it's goalless and it goes to the extra period. And there's a nothing foul by Ivano Bonetti. So basically, Bonetti controls the ball on the ground, and the Barcelona player who goes in for it then just basically hacks it a couple of times and falls over Bonetti.
Is it Pep?
No, it's Chicky Bagaristain.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So he goes down, the referee blows, and Mancini just gives the referee a look like, are you kidding? Because I think everybody knows what's happening now. Vialli, who I think by now is on the bench, can't watch, and Ronald Koeman steps up and Bosch.
Koeman toca socio Falaguero, pica Koeman, goal! Goal, 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 goal.
There's your last game with Sampdoria, ending in the worst way possible. The match finishes with Luca with his head shrouded by a damp towel. Mancini's in floods of tears, and it's all come to an end.
Oh, Boskov leaves as well.
Sven
is coming in.
I mean, they have some good times afterwards. I'm not going to say they didn't, but something very special ended that day. Next stop, grey sombre Turin at the foot of the Alps. Mare Mare by Luca Carboni, which I like to think was on Gianluca's mind as he drove northeast up to Turin, away from the Ligurian coastline and towards his new reality. Gab.
When he moved to Juventus, he still didn't have an agent. And he had no idea how much, you know, he should be getting paid by Juve. And, you know, agents had already cropped into the game. So he asked Mantovani not just to negotiate his transfer fee, but to negotiate his wages at Juventus, which, you know, today is like the biggest conflict of interest in the world. But that was the level of trust. And if you want, in some ways, maybe some would call it naive, you know, to do that. It's unthinkable today. But Mantovani went and negotiated Luca's 4-year deal at Juventus, you know, sitting across the table. I don't know if Moggi was already there infecting things.
No.
But
because he goes to play on the Trap. Trap's his first manager there. And this was pre the triad.
This is the thing. It's that he's left the Samp family behind. He now arrives at this club, which he's got. I mean, where before it was an automatic selection, him and Mancini up top. Now he's got Baggio, Casaraghi, who else? Di Canio's there, Andreas Muller. Also, he's arrived for 45 billion lira. I mean, it was a world record fee at the time.
Yes. I mean, this is the same time as Lentini's going to Milan, no?
So I'm not sure. I think maybe Vialli was first and then Lentini broke it.
Certainly
the
in the build up to the 92 European Cup final. There's an issue in that essentially these two big transfers are overshadowing Samp Barcelona.
Right.
There's more interest in what Juventus and Milan are doing in kind of the transfer market than there is in Samp actually being in the European final.
So he's arrived with this massive price, that classic story, and all of a sudden he's not really finding his feet. There are injury issues. Things go so badly in terms of him scoring that Trapattoni essentially tries to turn him into a midfielder. Do you remember that in the 92?
Yes, I do. So he was 28 years old at the time.
Is he already 28? It's remarkable.
July 9th, 1964.
Right.
He was actually born to the day 4 years before Paolo Di Canio. Okay. Same day.
Same birthday.
And the curious thing about this, and this is something that you see a little bit, there's a weird parallel, and whenever I bring it up, he gets a little annoyed, and you see why, with Wayne Rooney. Because it was around that age that Wayne Rooney kind of stopped being what he was, and him saying like, well, you know, maybe I can play midfield when my legs go and stuff like that. So that was kind of the aura that was created around it. And, oh yeah, look at him. He can play in midfield because, you know, he doesn't have the acceleration that he had, and it did not go down well and it did not work out well.
Right. But for those first 2 years, he doesn't work out well either. He's not scoring a lot of goals. And it's not until Marcello Lippi arrives in 94 that things really change. And boy, do they change.
And the first meeting that they have, I think Vialli basically says, I want to go back to Sampdoria. And he'd worked with Lippi. Oh, I say he'd worked with Lippi. Lippi was at Samp when when Viali first moved there.
Was he what, Lippi in charge of the youth team?
Was in charge of the Primavera, and okay. He used to catch cigarettes off Lippi. So they used to get on quite well. And Lippi, I think, basically says to him, you know, why would I sell the best Italian striker? Why would I let that happen? You're going to be a big part of this team. Persuades him to stay. And obviously, he's part of not only a side that wins the league title, but wins the Champions League, the European Cup that he couldn't win with Samp.
What a
Juventus captain to do it as well.
So true. The lineup is extraordinary. I mean, Lippi basically goes with three up front. It's Ravanelli and Viali, the classic formation with, at first, Baggio and then Del Piero. And it kind of ushers in a new way of doing it, particularly from the forwards' point of view. I mean, they press high, they work hard. They're a different kind of concept.
Yeah, it's very much high energy, right? So in Italy, you have this sort of endless preoccupation about, oh, mustn't put too many attacking players on the pitch, otherwise who's going to defend? And Lippi kind of cuts through that and says, well, hey, I mean, I wouldn't quite call it pressing as we know it, because it wasn't necessarily a high press. What it was they had the three guys up, but they would take turns coming back to midfield, tracking the fullbacks, you know, doing a lot of the things that we take for granted today, but wasn't necessarily the case in a lot of football back then, where, you know, there was this belief that the striker had to stay fresh. And they were also a side that simply had more energy and were just often physically stronger than most of the opposition. Viali used to say that, you know, he wasn't the fastest guy, but he would sprint 20 times a game. And the difference is, if it was him against a center back, you know, the first 10 times the center back might beat him, but the 11th time Luca would beat him,
right?
Because his 11th sprint was only marginally slower than his first sprint, whereas everybody else, their stamina would go down.
Right, because fitness was such an extraordinary, and you can interpret extraordinary however you want, but extraordinary feature about that Juventus team. Obviously, this became an issue with the court case later on featuring Dr. Agricola, but...
Get out the pharmacy, James.
They had a pharmacy worthy of a small hospital. But without doubt, whatever else went on with creatine and etc., which wasn't illegal, there was an unbelievable amount of work both done under Ventroni, the marine, the guy who was in charge of fitness.
Didn't they have a bell at the training ground where you basically had to ring the bell if you couldn't keep going?
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's like that kind
but
of
nobody rang.
It
was
a sort of mentality kind of fitness endurance kind of thing. Whereas
also they would turn up for they would do gym sessions before they even started their first training session of the day, and there was a competition to see who would get in first. Invariably, De Livio would win.
Il soldatino, the little soldier.
But they were all soldiers at Juve.
Yeah, I mean, so I met Ventrone. Luca and I went back to see him when we saw the book, and by this stage, sort of Ventrone's star had kind of dipped. I mean, that kind of idea of football and bulking players up and stuff had been sort of surpassed to some degree. But it was just funny because I don't know if he was playing a character. I'd never met the guy before. But he talked about how, you know, he was working with Ukrainian swimmers or whatever. And he's like, you know what? Those guys are athletes. 8 hours a day in the pool. And like, you know, look at these sissy footballers. Like, you know, you're lucky if you get like 2 hours of conditioning and 1 hour just kicking the ball about from them, you know. And I kept going on. I'm just like, Luca, is he always like this? And he says, like, yeah, I think, you know, he's kind of in his own world. And working with Ventrone at the time, and I think keeping a lot of people sane, was his assistant, this guy named Antonio Pintus, who Luca would later bring to Chelsea as his fitness coach at a time when, you know, most English clubs didn't have a fitness coach.
Zidane would take him to Real Madrid. He's now with Inter, with Conte.
Conte, of course, naturally thrived in that environment.
Conte, who was in that midfield behind Luca Ravanelli and Baggio Del Piero. So
or he was on the bench sometimes.
Okay, or on the bench.
Working on his hair.
It was such a...
No, I mean, he shaved it off, Gab, so it could grow back stronger. And
no,
boy,
he
it has.
It worked well. He took a different approach, but a more successful one.
It only comes back if God loves you.
Right. So so anyway, what emerged from the red-hot heat of Ventroni's forge was a new Viali, one who, in terms of scoring spectacular goals, in terms of leading a modern football line, was even more efficient and effective than ever before.
Yeah, and he really loved this side of it. He really loved the kind of, you know, let's go to battle. Like, as I said, I take you back what I said at the beginning. You know, if he'd not been a footballer, he probably would have been a soldier, because he likes the training and the gym rat. you know, that was a big part of him growing up. I think there was an element of vanity perhaps there as well, in the sense that, you know, he liked to take his shirt off and show off his six pack and whatever. And that, again, that fit the time, that fit the mid-90s, that fit that brand of football. And it's weird when you said, like, you know, you can't see the sea from Turin either. But I think he did develop a certain affection for Turin and for the fact that he got to see, you know, the wider world or a bigger city beyond Sampdoria, as difficult as those first 2 years were.
I mean, 1994, 95, which is obviously when they win the league title for the first time in 9 years, he has, you know, his second best season in the league in terms of goals scored, 17, compared to when he won the league title with Sampi, scored 19, which, given that they're four seasons apart and he's coming towards the end of his Italian career.
Yeah, 94, 95, yeah, he would have been 30. And we should also underscore to young listeners who are used to everybody playing 4-3-3 and everything, you know, going through Aguero or whoever your center, Lewandowski, your center forward is. He played in a front three with other goal scorers. So, you know, Ravanelli's
just got way more than
center forward, yeah. And I think you'll find that young Alex Del Piero also scored a fair few goals in his career.
They win how many titles with him in his four seasons at Juve?
Two, no? Two, 94, 95, 95, 96. Did they win the title then?
No,
or was
Milan
that?
Did.
No, Milan did, yeah.
He also finishes his
Capello did, in fact. And if he finds out that you took a title away from him, he's not going to be happy with you.
It's fine. Ronaldo hasn't beaten a man in 3 years.
He finished his diploma as well as part of his further education, which he's continued with. We'll touch on that another time. And once again, he plays a Champions League final, a European title game in his final act with a club. It was Sampdoria before, the game with Barcelona at Wembley. This time with Juve, he's taking on Ajax down in Rome, knowing that he's not going to be staying in Turin any longer. The club, I think, had come to him beforehand and said, we'd love you to stay. We're prepared to offer you a fifth of what you were on before.
I think it was a fifth, but he just says, they made me an offer. It was the kind of offer that said loud and clear, We really don't want you to stay.
And as he leaves the office, what, Christian Vieri walks through the door, something like that.
96, and this is end of May in Rome, in the Champions League final. And he's feeling like a man with something to prove as he takes the field at the Stadio Olimpico?
He feels that, yeah, he's got a ton to prove. He's got the fact that it's his second European Cup final after not playing very well in the one before. It's the fact that Juventus have pretty much shown him the door by, you know, offering him the kind of contract, which, as he puts it, you know, is a loud and clear signal that we don't want you to sign it. You know, he's 32 years old at this stage, or he's about to turn 32.
He's captain of the team as well.
He's captain of the team. On top of that, he is a guy who, you know, outwardly, you would see him perhaps being slightly cool. And, you know, I remember when he came over because he wore V-necks, you know, the English people, oh, look, he's so sophisticated, you know. But he's a guy who gets really emotionally involved in what he does. And it takes a ton, out of him. I mean, he would talk about how later on when he became a manager, it would just consume him the whole time. You know, he'd be eating breakfast and stuff, and, you know, he'd start seeing formations and he'd start seeing, like, his players, you know, around him, you know. And so he had this emotional...
Molding it out of mashed potato in the middle of the table.
Exactly, and, like, yeah, you know, like you see Dennis Wise's head in there, you know, or worse, you know, yeah. Nightmares of Hullet, you know. So all these things coming together, I mean, he really was a bundle of nerves. And that said... And I think this doesn't just apply to him. It applies to great athletes. When you're under so much tension, when you've got so much stuff going on, the really good, really great athletes often manage to go and channel that, all that emotion, all that nervous energy, to channel it into tremendous performance, channel it positively. And obviously that's what he was able to do.
Was he able to do? I don't remember him having a particularly good game.
Well, he didn't screw things up.
He didn't screw things up. But he did win. That's the main thing. I mean, Juve won on penalties.
And every time that Juventus have been to a final since.
Yeah.
And they've been to a lot of finals.
Losing most of them.
He always says that, you know, I want someone else who's captain of that club to lift that trophy, because right, I'm the last person who's photographed lifting that trophy. And
his little blue shirt.
Yeah. It's a good shirt, actually.
His time at Juve was a remarkable success story. Is it anything like as special to him as the Samp years?
That's a question for him to answer.
Right.
I mean, I think...
The way he talks about it, I mean, when you talk about his backstory.
Look, he's played for five clubs. If I was to guess...
Pizzighettone.
Six, if you count Pizzighettone. All right, let's leave out Pizzighettone for a minute. But if he had to get one club tattooed, I think the hierarchy would go Sampdoria, Cremonese, Chelsea.
Pizzighettone.
No, enough with the Pizzighettone. Italy and Juve.
Italy.
I think so. I think that, especially, you know, what happened in 85, what happened in 88.
Right.
And what happened in Italian 90, those are, you know, Italy and Juventus kind of left you thinking. I mean, even though Juventus obviously was ultimately successful and he had success there on the pitch, I think in the back of his mind kind of left him wondering what might have been.
Right.
You know, I don't think he regrets anything about the 8 years at Sampdoria, but I think equally he realizes, wow, you know, if I'd been at another club in another era, who knows what might have happened?
Who knows?
I think that's only human.
All right. Well, we'll talk about some of the things that did happen, some of the things that didn't, when we return for the next part of this Golazzo special on Gianluca Vialli, as we discuss the move to West London, the Italy years, the not Italy years, the life after football, and whether one day he's going to ride to Sampdoria's rescue. That's all coming up in the next part of our Golazzo Gianluca Vialli special. For now, though, from Gabriele, James, and myself, it's many thanks for listening, and arrivederci.
You've been listening to Golazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Check out our other football shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audioboom, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.